Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing, publishing options, and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 311 of the podcast. It's Sunday, 5th of March, 2017, as I record this from Bath, England. Yes, I'm back home. I'm very happy to be here and getting on with writing again. Although, as I'll explain in my personal update coming soon, things are about to change yet again. So today I have a really interesting interview with Dave Cusack on the parallels between the music industry and being an indie author. And of course, the music industry has been ahead of publishing in the shift from big labels to indies. Prince was a famous indie, of course. And also the music industry shifted from physical albums to digital music, and then streaming and subscription models, micropayments, and the rise of niche print retro products like vinyl records. So it's there's so many parallels that it's super interesting. It's like looking into the future of what's going to happen with books because of what's happened to music. And artists make money through royalties from intellectual property, as well as events and that type of thing. They have multiple streams of income. And in fact, some of them sign terrible contracts, as we've heard recently. Paul McCartney has raised a lawsuit to try and get back some of the rights to the Beatles' early work. You know, the things you sign when you're a nobody and then you become the Beatles. Of course, that won't happen to all of us, but it's still an interesting example with contracts. So there are so many parallels, and I think you'll find this conversation really interesting. So in publishing news this week, Drafter Digital posted a quote from Hugh Howey, which I liked and also seemed relevant to today's discussion on music. Quote, "I think we are just moments away from entering an age where indie writers will have the same cachet as indie filmmakers and indie musicians. Here's a far-off prediction. I think we'll see a point in our lifetimes where traditionally published material is made to appear self-published in order to give it street cred." End quote. So the lovely Hugh Howey, who is off sailing around the world, I think he's in the Galapagos at the moment, but that's certainly an interesting thought. And definitely I've had comments that people are like, yeah, I want to join the cool kids and be an indie author. And I'm like, yeah, you know, maybe we're almost the cool kids. But this is also an interesting thought, because this week The Guardian in the UK reported that big brand UK bookstore Waterstones has opened several small bookshops in smaller towns, which are not branded with the Waterstones name, but with an independent look. They all have different names. They're small stores. And there was an article about whether these small unbranded stores are a threat to independent bookshops, or whether they are a good thing because more bookshops on the high street is a good idea. But it reminded me of this Hugh Howey quote, because basically, you know, a big brand posing as an independent to, you know, because the shoppers are presumably looking for that independent bookstore. So, and a lot of things came up this week, and I wanted to talk about, you know, publishing in general in my little introduction. And last week I challenged you to think about 2023, which isn't so far away, because as I mentioned last week, I was in Brisbane, Australia, and when I left there 6 years ago, my life was so different and the publishing industry was so different, and self-publishing was, you know, unrecognizable, and things change a lot in 6 years. And some figures came up this week that might make you think about what could be the reality in 2023 and thinking about where we want it to be. So first of all, Amazon Studios, Manchester by the Sea, won 2 Academy Awards, which is pretty amazing. They also make Emmy award-winning TV. So Amazon is certainly a force to be reckoned with in content production. I'm a happy Prime member. You know, I love some of the Amazon TV shows. Man in High Castle was a particularly good one. So
Amazon Studios, and I'm working, well, I'm not working, there is a screenwriter working on Desecration and the London Psychic series, and I think we will definitely be pitching Amazon Studios. So, you know, awesome. Then Jane Friedman posted 9 statistics writers should know about Amazon. And she posted that 8 of the top 20 Kindle bestsellers in 2016 were from Amazon's own publishing imprints. Amazon now has 13 active house imprints. And in 2016 alone, Amazon Publishing released more than 2,000 titles. Amazon is the largest publisher of literature and translation. Amazon Crossing surpassed all other US imprints and publishers in releasing translated fiction. In 2015, it published 75 translated books, 50 more than the next biggest publisher. Mark Williams in the International Indie Author Facebook group, which has a really good take on other things happening in the world that is not US centric, really interesting group. And it's an open group, so you can look for that, International Indie Author on Facebook. Mark wrote an interesting post and said that 55% of the UK top 20 books are Amazon's own. And as he wrote the post, it's 50% of the top 20 in Amazon.com. He's saying that last year, Amazon released about 2,000 new titles, and the best guess is that they have about 5,000 titles out there right now. He says, quote, "This is the cold reality of digital publishing in 2017, where our biggest competition as indies comes not from traditional publishing, but from the very retailer we most rely on to compete against traditional publishing." And in terms of the number of books in the top 20 and the changes in the store, that is really interesting. And he does say, don't misread this as a rant against Amazon. Amazon Publishing is a quality press, and we should be hoping for a chance to join the imprint. And it's the holy grail for indie authors, not in the mega sales league. And certainly, I am very interested in an Amazon Publishing deal for something, not all my books. But I think as I grow my own backlist and see the potential there and see the dominance in the books in the charts, I mean, it's crazy not to think that way. I'm actually going to put my first book in the new series, the map book series, into the Amazon Storyteller competition, which is a UK only competition, ends end of May. I mean, who knows, but I've got a deadline for that, so that'll be fun. But Mark says diversity in distribution, format and content becomes ever more important if we are still to be on the author circuit in any meaningful way in the next decade. On top of this, Barnes & Noble reports revenues down in their third quarter 2017, which included the holiday season. Nook sales declined 25.7%, reported on the Digital Reader. So another, you know, a lot of people look at Barnes & Noble and Nook and wonder when or if it might ever pull back up again. So I just, you know, wanted to talk about this and have us all think about the sort of next 6 years and the decisions we make. I love Amazon. I'm not Amazon bashing. KDP changed my life as a writer, and many writers. Amazon changed the whole world for authors. And as a reader, I read on my Kindle. I'm a Prime member. I want Amazon to continue their focus on customer satisfaction because, yeah, I am one. So, but on the other hand, you have this worry that we will, as true indies who are not necessarily in Amazon publishing or as a new author getting started or as someone writing in the niches, that we won't be able to get a foothold in the store in the future. So really interesting dichotomy, I think, to try and hold in your head when you're considering whether to go KDP Select to put all your money in Amazon's basket or to go wide to think about the rest of the world. I think these are things for us to think about. And also, what kind of publishing environment do we want by 2023? And I certainly think that being part of the Alliance of Independent Authors, which is an industry organization for or, you know, independent authors, and together we can lobby. So this is really important. As an individual, you cannot lobby in any meaningful way, but together we can lobby to make sure that our rights are not eroded in some way. I mean, I made a sort of pledge back in 2011 when I was laid off as part of the global financial crisis that I would never let one company be in charge of all my income. And so it's a bit like rebalancing your investment portfolio, which is something I'm looking at the moment, you know, rebalancing your dependence on different income streams. So I'm going to do a blog post on my figures for 2017, but I am happy to say that Amazon don't have 80% of my of my income. They're actually a lot smaller than that now. So I think we all need to make sure that our own lifestyle, our own choices, our own income streams are safe going forward. And Christine Catherine Rush wrote a really good post this week on money for authors and how when the good times are here, we need to make sure we put money aside for the bad times. And, you know, really interesting stuff to think about. Okay, so that's my serious look at publishing this week. But also, talking of change to come, I read an interesting book on the flight back from Australia, The Fourth Transformation by Robert Scoble and Shel Israel, about the transition from screens and smartphones to headsets and wearables. Yes, VR, AR and MR, mixed reality, which it's the first time I've heard that term, but actually this mixed reality seems like a really good middle ground, because you can't imagine yourself wearing a headset all the time, obviously, because you're like in your little box. But the augmented reality and this mixed reality idea, and the fact that companies like Magic Leap and Apple are looking at these type of technologies, we could be wearing the smart glasses that are much better than the Google Glass, which was a bit of a disaster. But really interesting book, The Fourth Transformation by Scoble and Israel. And I will be discussing this more with Thad McElroy, who runs the Future of Publishing blog, and we will be geeking out on this stuff next month. Okay, so my personal update, as the rain hammers on the window, I actually love being back in the winter. I went for a walk yesterday and the spring is definitely here. The daffodils are out. Crocuses, I love crocuses. So really wonderful to be back. I obviously had a great trip, but happy to be home. But it's a short week, as I'll be heading to London Book Fair the week after next, and I'll be reporting back on that. Make sure you check out the Indie Author Fringe, which is the Alliance of Independent Authors reportage as such on the London Book Fair. And there's a ton of sessions that will be run. It's all an online conference. It's all free. You will get the recording of me speaking alongside indie superstar Adam Croft, who's been on the show, who made seven figures with his crime novels last year. I'm not quite sure. We're speaking on like how to sell more books, and I'm laughing because I'm not sure I can stand next to Adam and talk about selling more books when he's just done so well. But that's coming up. Go to selfpublishingadvice.org and register on the Indie Author Fringe page to get notification of all the events, online free events you can get through the Fringe. Then I can announce what I'm doing the week after. I am off to America. So yes, no sooner as I get back, I'm leaving again. So we've been keeping this a secret, but we can now announce it. So my friend Jay Thorne had a cool idea, my co-author on Risen Gods. And Jay's co-written with a lot of people. He's like the master of co-writing. He's a musician as well. And I think that makes a big difference to collaboration, because musicians, I think, are a lot more happy to collaborate, or are more used to collaborating than authors. But Jay emailed me back, it must have been back in October, and said, hey, how about four authors get on a train and write a book together? And I was like, yeah, that sounds amazing. So cut a long story short, me and Jay Thorne plus Lindsay Barocca and Zach Bohannon are getting on a train in Chicago, and we've discussed is that the book will be in the American Demon Hunters universe, so it will be dark fantasy probably. So we're going to get on the train in Chicago, and we will travel down country to New Orleans, and we're going to plot when we get on the train together, and we're going to write the book. We're spending a week in New Orleans, and we'll be writing the book that week. Probably, 15 to 20,000 words each will make a decent sized book. So not a big deal. I think the trick will be designing the book so that it doesn't read as a really crazy mishmash. We've talked about something like From Dusk Till Dawn on a Train. And as I said, it will be in Jay's American Demon Hunters universe, but we're not going to get into any more details. I'm obviously thinking about my character, and there will be four point of view characters. So yeah, very cool. It's going to be a lot of creative fun. It's one of those projects that I feel very lucky to be able to do at this point in my career, because it might not make any money at all. It's obviously quite expensive for me to go to America for a week, but it doesn't matter, because I will learn a lot from Jay, Lindsay and Zach that week, and it will be well worth it and hopefully a lot of fun. You can go to jaythorne.net/American Demon Hunters to read a bit more about it, and that book will be out in April. I'm also going to research for an Arcane book while I'm there, so it's definitely a work trip, but I've always wanted to visit New Orleans, so it will be an awesome trip. Other updates, I finished the outline of the map book series and am ready to write that, but because of the US trip and LBF, a London Book Fair, I'm actually going to have to wait until April to write that. And then, as I said, I'm going to try and get that into the Amazon competition, which closes end of May. So I mean, that's pretty good. I can normally do a book that fast, and I've got my editing set up. And today I've also been editing the co-written Sweet Romance, which will also come out this year. So I'm hardcore upping my production in Q2 of 2017, because I do feel like I'm really behind already with this year. The trip was great, but definitely didn't get what I wanted to get done. But hey, seeing your family is important. I am going to cut down a lot more of my travel this year. So I've cancelled a number of trips because I need to write more. I have way too many stories and books that I want to get done. And while I was away, a lot of people told me that particularly the Successful Author Mindset made a lot of difference to their life. So I really want to write the Shadow book, which I've mentioned before, and a whole load of novels as well. And an article by Stephen Pressfield came out this week as well, which has helped me, and I've printed it out and put it in my journal. The title is Frank Sinatra Does Not Move Pianos. And it's basically about what you can uniquely do, what is the thing that only you can do. And that's the books I write and this podcast. The two, when I come down to it, the two things that are uniquely me are the books and the podcast. Talking about self-publishing, a lot of people do that. But the books that I want to write and this podcast, which I hope is much more individual these days, and also talking about different topics and having different people on the show. So I'm going to try and cut down on the other stuff going forward, but as you know, I'm not very good at focus, but I'm really going to try this year. Okay, so thanks for all your emails and tweets and comments this week. Richard said, it was nice to hear you reflect on your journey. I've been listening to your podcast for around 5 years. At the time I became a fan, I was an unpublished writer. This weekend, I hit publish on my 13th title, published my first box set, and am now outside of Amazon using Kobo. Thanks for all the suggestions. That's awesome. Thanks, Richard. And with as a 5-year listener, you're one of the hardcore. So thanks so much for your support. Ange de Lumiere said, reading your author blueprint, I love that your first book was not a success. It made me feel a bit better. Thanks, Ange. And just so you know, it's not just my first book that wasn't a success. Jay Thorne and I are currently updating Risen Gods with a new cover and new positioning, because we kind of got that a bit wrong. we're repositioning into more of urban fantasy. We've got a new cover and all of that. And so it doesn't have to be your first book that's not a success. It can be other books. Anna Proofing says, listening to the latest podcast while nursing my four-year-old with chicken pox and a temperature. Loads of great advice. Glad to give you something to do while being a nursemaid. Icy Cedric. Hi, Icy. He said, I've become one of those fans who listens to the show in the gym, learning while I'm burning. Fantastic. Alison Ingleby, a run in the sun before the rain hits with the show for company, taking this week's topic as a positive omen. And finally, Anya B says, writing down my 2023 vision, a useful exercise, shows me where I'm still lacking clarity. I'm glad you did that, Anya. And again, I've done that too. And what I did with mine actually was I actually redid it yesterday. I was looking at what I'd written down and I honed it down again to those two things, books, podcasts. You know, that's what I need to focus on. Okay, so today's show is sponsored by my own new audiobooks, How to Make a Living with Your Writing and also The Successful Author Mindset. Both are now available from Audible and also direct from the Creative Pen website. How to Make a Living with Your Writing continues to be one of my best-selling books. It was also one of Inc. magazine's top 100 business books of 2015. It has 169 reviews on Amazon.com with a 4.7 star average. And it goes into exactly how I make a multi six-figure income with my writing. And I also updated it for the audio edition. I updated it in January this year, 2017, to reflect the current situation. The Successful Author Mindset is the nonfiction book I am most proud of because it includes some of my own journals and I really bare my soul, and it's helped so many people realize that they're not alone with self-doubt, comparisonitis, fear of failure, creative disappointment, and much more. So if you'd like to add some more audio to your world, check out How to Make a Living with Your Writing and also The Successful Author Mindset in audiobook format. So this type of sponsorship pays for the hosting and transcription, but my time in producing the show is primarily sponsored by you guys. And a big thank you, as ever, to all the people supporting on Patreon. It means so much to me that you want the show to continue enough to throw in a few dollars a month. Thanks to new patrons, Brian Reller, Amelia Hay, Craig Mastro, John Sheets, and Jennifer Mabin. Thank you, everyone, and thanks to all the supporters on Patreon. I actually need to record the Patreon-only Q&A before the London Book Fair, so if you are a Patreon supporter, please go in and ask your questions in the next week. And if you'd like that extra audio and over a year's backlist of extra audio, you can support the show with just a few dollars a month, less than a coffee a month. So go to patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Thank you. Let's get on with the interview. Today, I'm here with Dave Cusack. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Joanna. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you on the show. Just a little introduction. Dave Cusack is a serial entrepreneur, digital music pioneer, and best-selling author. His online music school, New Artist Model, has helped thousands of musicians around the world pursue musical careers. Create.biz is his latest venture, an online business school for creative professionals. And today we're talking about what authors can learn from the music industry, which is super exciting. And of course, Dave, there is so much, isn't there, that we're going to get into?
Yeah, there are a lot of parallels and a lot of differences. So it'll be interesting to explore and to get your take on it as well.
Yeah, cool. So I want to start with, in 2005, you co-authored the best-selling music business book, The Future of Music, Manifesto for the Digital Music Revolution. So that's like 11, almost 12 years ago. So I wondered, you know, looking at now the state of music, how much of that book is true today? Like what is the current state of the music industry, especially in terms of digital and the changes that have happened?
Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, a great deal of the book has come true, which on one hand I'm happy about, and on another hand I'm not so happy about. You know, we've seen a destruction of the revenue model in the music business. And there are many, many parallels to writing, but in many ways, the music business has suffered significantly from the digital revolution, which is something that we could see coming. I mean, I was summarily escorted out of many record label offices in the early 90s as we began to late 90s, as we began to really see the writing on the wall and had conversations with many different companies and tried to make them aware of the change that was coming. And, you know, they just didn't want to hear it. So the digital has certainly become the dominant format in the music industry, but at the same time, the revenue model has collapsed to a large degree. Many of the things we talked about in the book have come to pass, things like Pandora and Spotify, all of the streaming sites. We pretty accurately predicted that. Things like the iPhone, which didn't exist at the time, technologies like Siri and Alexa that didn't exist at the time, we pretty accurately predicted. And, you know, unfortunately, we wrote that book as a warning, in a sense, to a lot of folks in the music industry. And unfortunately, they did not heed the warning.
Yeah. Well, no, that's really interesting. And I want to get more into that then. So you said the destruction of the revenue model and the collapse of the revenue model. Is that the collapse and destruction on behalf of the big companies who were basically built a model on sales of CDs and, you know, things through record stores, which would be the equivalent to bookstores? And has the revenue model just changed? So has it been a destruction and a creation in that, you know, are more artists making more money in the long tail? But, you know, do you know what I mean? It's like the destruction of music money is not gone completely, is it? It's just changed. So explain what it is now.
Sure. Well, I do mean the destruction of the revenue model, because the music industry has yet to recover from the beginning of the digital revolution. The industry is about one third the size that it was at the peak in its heyday around the year 2000. So you've got an industry that's quite popular and quite visible, yet they've seen their revenues fall by 60%, primarily in the record business, in the record labels. Unfortunately, the labels did not adopt the MP3 file as a format. They fought it tooth and nail, and consumers embraced it wholeheartedly. And, you know, we had a lot of the very early file sharing services, Napster and Kazaa and many others that are, you know, now they're gone, somewhat litigated out of existence. But consumers embraced those file sharing platforms wholeheartedly and really showed the industry that there was a huge market and appetite for digital music. It was very convenient, is very portable. You could search very easily. It made the record store experience, something that translated online into a much more robust search and exploration and discovery experience. Yet the record labels didn't monetize that format. And they actually, you know, you can remember they sued many of their customers in the early 2000s for sharing files and, quote, stealing music, when actually their customers were showing them, you know, an incredible desire for this format. And instead of, you know, really trying to monetize the format early on, they tried to change people's behavior in a very unsuccessful way. And as a result, the model has shifted significantly. You know, yes, there are more people making money on the long tail, but not very much money. And I think the transformation that you've seen in the writing and author space has not really occurred in the same way in the music space. You guys can still sell digital books, and it's very, very difficult to sell a digital recording these days, unless you've got massive promotion, massive exposure. It's very, very difficult to actually monetize a recording, which was the fuel that drove the industry for decades.
Mm. Wow, that's really interesting. And the, you know, and I just don't know enough about this area. And but although I was thinking about my behavior, so I don't buy a lot of music. I listen to the same things over and over again, which is, I think, one of the problems with people in their 40s. You know, they probably still listen to a lot of music they listened to when they were younger. But I did. I was watching The Young Pope, which was on. I was watching it on Amazon, and the song is stuck in my head. So I went to my iPhone. I went to the iTunes store on my iPhone and bought the song on my phone while I was watching the TV on streaming Amazon Prime TV. Mm-hmm. And just thinking about that as a model. Now, I know, and it's a small band who I can't remember off the top of my head. That's the thing. You know, I searched for the song and everything. I searched for the Young Pope, you know, soundtrack. And so consumer's behavior has changed as well. So just go a bit more into the revenue model, because of course it used to be sale of physical discs, or, you know, back in the day, tapes and things. Is it more streaming micro money, which I've heard there's a service where that collects these micro payments for people. Is it live events and Kickstarter and Patreon and these kind of different online models than just sales?
The transformation to digital in music began with the MP3 file being effectively free. So massive amounts of music was consumed in that format. Then it moved to a paid download, notably Apple iTunes and their 99-cent download. Had a pretty good run there for a while. And then it shifted to streaming, which is micropayments. And streaming has become the dominant format right now here in 2017. 2016, it kind of flipped into streaming becoming the preferred format now. And again, this is something that we wrote about in our book, that, you know, music would be ubiquitous. It would be always on, always available, an infinite supply. Every song ever recorded at your fingertips. And when you look at Spotify, for example, that's basically what it is. Every song you could possibly imagine is available there, either for free or for a low monthly subscription. That's been great for consumers and fans of music. It's been great for bands in a sense that it's now possible to get really massive exposure and distribution of your music broadly and very quickly, but it's very, very difficult to actually monetize those streams. You're talking hundredths of a cent per stream. And I've got many friends that are pretty successful musicians where, you know, they get checks from their collection societies for streaming, and, you know, it amounts to a nice Italian dinner a month. You can't really live off of that.
Yeah. I know that's interesting. And I think the micro payment, what is the website that's the main micro payment collector?
Well, there are several. It depends on where the music is presented. One company is called Sound Exchange, and Sound Exchange collects a lot of the streaming revenue and a lot of the web related revenue. There are still performing rights organizations here in the States. ASCAP, BMI, CSAC is kind of North American. There are performing rights organizations in every country that collect a lot of radio airplay. And per public performance airplay. So if you're songs are played in a supermarket or a restaurant, the performing rights organization collects money there. It's a very fragmented, financial system for musicians in terms of recorded music. You could sell it yourself off of your own website. You could sell recordings at your shows. You could sell downloads on iTunes or Amazon or elsewhere, and you can have your streams out there. And what I just described, the revenue basically goes like this.
Yeah.
So the most popular formats have the lowest possible revenue.
How interesting.
Attached to them.
And I mean, when we're talking about this, I'm thinking, Amazon clearly looked at the music industry and went, let's invent the thing that's inevitably coming and invent the Kindle and eBooks in that way. And the micropayments now are KDP page reads, where you get paid per page read on the device, and also PLR and ALCS, which are in Britain, the collecting societies. And so they were for photocopies so in that way, it's quite similar, I think. Now, I wanted to drill down, you mentioned they're like performance rights. So I wanted to ask you about intellectual property when it comes to music, because I know there's quite a lot of musicians who listen to the show as well, who are authors as well as musicians. And some people compose like a soundtrack to their book, for example. So just sort of explain broadly, obviously there's loads, but sort of what are the kind of categories of intellectual property rights when it comes to music?
When you create a song, you're actually awarded 6 different rights. And there are 2 categories of rights. One is in the song itself, the composition itself. It's sort of an abstract idea of the song, the melody, the lyrics. And then there's the recording or the physical manifestation or the digital manifestation of that song. So you have rights awarded in both categories, and you can distribute copies of your music and either let that go for free or charge for it. You can publicly perform your music and receive a royalty from that. You can license your music to others to record, which can be very lucrative for songwriters and composers and producers. You can license your music for film and television, which again can be very lucrative. You can license your music for use online, such as on YouTube. Which is an emerging revenue stream for many musicians. If you're able to embrace sort of a shift in thinking, YouTube has a content ID system that basically watermarks and tracks intellectual property. And if you leverage that content ID system, anyone who uses your music is a potential distribution channel for you, and a revenue stream for you. So there are lots of ways to monetize the music itself. You can make money off the lyrics. You can make money off the sheet music. But these days, the public performance of music that you would garner as a songwriter, or the public performance of music that you would garner as a performing artist, is primarily the way people make money. That's number one. And revenue around that, selling merchandise, t-shirts, and that kind of thing. And then licensing and publishing your music as a songwriter so that other folks would record it, or it would be used on film, TV, or YouTube, or other digital properties, perhaps video games. That's probably the number 2 source of revenue right now.
Yeah, that's great, because so many authors think that, oh, you just write a book and then you sell it on Amazon and that's it. But there are actually all these types of intellectual property rights when it comes to exploiting them. And I wanted to pick up there, you mentioned lyrics, that the lyrics, there's a copyright applied to that. And many authors want to quote song lyrics as part of their novels. And generally the overarching recommendation is don't do that. have you come across these types of things before? Like, what would you recommend, just not using lyrics in books because of this right?
Well, it's a good question. And I'm not an attorney.
Yeah, this is just our opinion.
I have found that if things are excerpted, you're often okay. If they're used in a way to illustrate a concept in the sense of fair use here in the U.S., you tend to be okay. So if you quote the entire song in your book, you probably need permission for that. And many times you can get that. But if you quote an excerpt, perhaps a verse or a chorus, you probably can get away with that, as long as you give attribution to the songwriter and the publisher.
Yeah, and I'll just direct people to the interview with Helen Sedwick, who is an attorney and does talk about this in an interview I did with her. So just direct people at that. So just going back to the performance and the merchandise. So do musicians basically have to get out there and do these kind of live events? Is that just the way that most of them have to make money if it's their job?
Yeah, at the moment, that is the... you know, one of the top two revenue streams. So if you're a songwriter and performer, you could make money licensing and performing. If you're more of a performer and perhaps play other people's songs or have a mix of things that you write or your band writes and other folks write, then your path to revenue is performing at the moment. You know, I do think that there will be digital performance opportunities emerging as that becomes more acceptable to people, kind of pay-per-view concerts online, various experiments now that are going on in kind of the VR space. I think that could have some real potential for people. But, you know, effectively, a musician is an entertainer, and your job is to go out and entertain people. And, you know, that's traditionally been some form of a concert or a live performance. That's really where music came from. You know, and you think back on, you know, way back when, the music industry really is less than 100 years old. When you really look about how it was driven by radio and various formats that were distributed, records, tapes, CDs, et cetera, It predates to less than 100 years old. And if you go to prior to that, music was pretty much a performance situation. There weren't many of these other revenue streams. And quite often, the performance was subsidized by a patron. Mm. And, you know, you see that today with Patreon and Kickstarter and other sites like that. You know, it's basically a digital version of this patronage model that has really supported the arts for forever.
Yeah, and we have a lot of wonderful Patreon supporters who support this show. So it works for a spoken word as well. But I was on Patreon because I think it's starting to tip over into the mainstream. Like, I think it's been on the edge, but people are now getting it and starting to use it a lot more. And I saw that Amanda Palmer has $33,000 a month from Patreon, which... it's just, I think it's either per month or per creative thing that she does. Right. But I mean, that's incredible. So, I mean, clearly she's a big name. Well, she's not a big name. She's actually quite a niche name, but she has built up an audience over years. And I think she was the first one to use Kickstarter for an album. So these type of new models can be very successful, I guess, but you need an audience.
Well, she wasn't the first one to use Kickstarter by a long shot, but she was the first one with a sizable audience to use Kickstarter. And I think she was the first one to gross over $1 million on her project.
Yes, I think you're right. Mm.
But it takes an audience, and it's so critical. I mean, it's a lot of what I do in my everyday life is helping musicians and creative people create and develop their audience. That's the tender of the realm these days. If you want to have a successful career, you need to develop an audience or a fan base. And once you have that, you can do wonderful things. And Amanda is a great example of that.
Mm. So what do you advise musicians, you know, how do they build up a fan base? Because it's exactly the same for writers.
Well, you've got to focus on it. You've got to get yourself in a position where you're able to collect emails. That's the preferred way to do it, as you well know. And you want to drive your social interactions to your website, where you're collecting email and you're trading email for something of value. Could be songs, could be lyrics, could be insights into your work or your life. The people have a lot of different takes on it. But the holy grail of the moment is having a large following represented in an email list that you are then able to directly promote your shows to, your music to, your appearances to, your merchandise to, your friends to. It gives you just so much flexibility in terms of how you pursue your career. You know, an interesting thing when you think of the heyday of the record business, which is what really people think about the music business. Mm-hmm. You know, you think of the Rolling Stones and the Beatles and Elton John and, you know, massive stars. The labels really had no idea who their customers were. Mm-hmm. They had no mailing list. They thought their customer were Waterloo and Tower Records. And so, you know, when this digital shift occurred and the labels found that people were basically just grabbing the music for free, they had no ability to communicate directly with a fan base. Mm. They didn't have a fan base in a 2017 sense of being able to identify and directly reach your fan base, other than perhaps at a live show where you, as you're Steven Tyler from Aerosmith and you're on the stage, you can say whatever you want. Mm. Right. But the label didn't really have that power. So in a sense, you know, I think that we're in a transition period in the music industry where it is difficult to monetize recordings. It is difficult to monetize the most popular digital format. But it's pretty easy to start building your audience. And I think as we go forward in the next few years, the musicians that do spend energy building an audience and creating relationships with their audience are going to be in a better position to take advantage of the new formats and new performance opportunities that there may be online. I do think that there's music business has always been driven by format changes, radio to vinyl to cassette tapes to 8-track tapes to CDs. Then there was this MP3 that they really just completely missed the boat on. And now you've got streaming, which, you know, the tech companies are doing quite well off of, you know, Amazon, Apple, Spotify, Pandora. They're taking the lion's share of the revenue there. The labels are getting a small piece and the artists are getting a tiny, tiny piece. But I think there will be another format that we'll see in the coming years that hopefully artists with a fan base will be able to embrace those formats and really capitalize on them.
No, I really like that. And I think you're right. I also think that the format thing, I mean, I just can't believe that what we have as ebooks now are the ultimate form of reading. I mean, they're not, you know, that there must be better ebooks and we're starting to move towards it. But as things shift, you know, you have to kind of upgrade your format, which people aren't really used to, especially authors, but I think musicians as well. So I think I agree with that. I also wanted to ask you, you talked there about the massive stars, you know, like Elton John and, you know, people who are now dying. not that Elton John has died, but lots of people, obviously, last year, David Bowie, you know, Prince, you know, people, these mega stars. And I've been feeling with books, because the publishing model has been very similar. The mega star authors who've traditionally been who are older. They're in their mid-60s. They're Stephen King, James Patterson, Nora Roberts, the people who every year are at the top of the Forbes mm-hmm. richest author list. They are all pretty old, and they've all been traditionally published for 30 plus years. So they're kind of part of the old industry. They're not part of the new industry, and they won't be. So what I'm thinking is it's the end of megastars, and it's now more about this long tail, about people, because as a consumer, you want this little bit. Not everyone is listening to the same thing. Not everyone is reading the same thing anymore or watching the same thing. We're all in these sort of sub niches. Do you see that sort of parallel?
Yes, I do. I think there's a huge fragmentation of opportunity for people, and it is really important to define your niche and to create some activity around your art. I mean, audience doesn't really form around, nothing. It forms around some form of energy and some form of creative expression. And to the extent that you can focus your energy on a niche, define it, promote yourself in that niche, you can be very successful, as you well know. As long as the revenue model is there to support what you're trying to do. I have a question for you.
Yeah.
As you see transition, you talked about payment per page view on KDP. How do you feel about that? Rather than somebody downloading one of your books for a few dollars, being paid some micro payment.
Yeah, well, I'm one of those people who doesn't do that model. It's an exclusivity model that only happens on Amazon if you're exclusive to Amazon and you opt into KDP Select, which you basically can't publish on any other platform. I'm someone who doesn't like one company to control all my money. So I don't have any books in KDP Select. It's something I am going to look at this year. But and some people have done really well with it and other people haven't. And some people have been earning, like six figures a month, and then they change the algorithm and they end up with, like four figures a month. So yeah. I think making your revenue stream dependent on one company is a really bad idea.
Yeah, I would concur. And, I think that trend of pay-per-view, not in the kind of ultimate fight club sense, but in the, something passes by your senses and either you're paid or you're not. I think it's a very dangerous revenue model for creators. I think it perhaps can be a wonderful revenue model for the distributors, the Amazons and the Apples of the world. It can be extremely lucrative, especially if you're a device maker. But if you're an author or musician or photographer or filmmaker, that's pretty shaky ground as we move forward. I would really watch out for that. Anybody listening, it's very shaky ground. I can tell you from the music business, we've unfortunately, presaged a lot of the other creative industries. And yes, you can learn from the music business, but be careful you don't make the same mistakes.
Absolutely. And I think building up your own audience, I mean, I look at Amanda Palmer and I'm like, that is, if you want to make money and be an artist, you just build your own audience. That literally is the answer. And the only way you build your audience is by producing your art and telling people about it in some way. Now, obviously, she's quite extreme in her openness and, vibrancy and everything. Most people listening are not her personality type, but there are lots of ways to do it. Now, I did want to ask you about the merchandise, because one of my picks for this year, and in fact, I'm doing one myself, like I see the trend towards digital, but there's also a trend towards beautiful print products. So hardback books with beautiful images and fonts and hand lettering and lovely texture. So there's this dichotomy, between cheaper digital and more expensive print products. Is that happening in music with like more expensive, like free music or cheap music and expensive old LP covers or other merchandise?
Yes, and that's a very good question. As the as the revenue from recordings has decreased, artists have been forced to become very creative in how they can monetize their merchandise. For example, is a huge revenue stream for the road warriors out there that are playing 200 shows a year or more. And it's gone way beyond the t-shirt. So premium merchandise, a signed guitar, for example, can command thousands of dollars. So I recommend to my students and my members that you create a tiered set of merchandise. And you look at, you know, at the bottom end, it's things like stickers and photographs that are impulse purchases for people. Then, you know, the traditional stuff, hats and t-shirts and banners and posters that people will be interested in. And then you look at a higher tier where you're actually creating higher value merchandise. So it could be very popular these days is a higher weight vinyl. It's actually become, I think, 7 or 8% of revenue in recording this past year was vinyl, if you can believe that. But people are personalizing not only artifacts like records or guitars or, you know, clothing, but they're personalizing experiences also for their fans. Come behind the scenes into the studio with me, either virtually through Skype or something, or literally. Or we'll have a writing camp where I'm going to invite 30 people at $2,000 a pop, and we're gonna write songs together. And you know, I can make 60 grand in a weekend if I'm an artist thinking that way. So merchandise and creating higher value products is very lucrative for many people. Personalization is important with print on demand. I think that's something that, you know, authors could look at because people will pay for things where you give them a special message or you give their husband or wife a special message. They will pay significantly for that. So I think there's a lot more to do there. And that's a very interesting intersection between physical and digital. Can I print merchandise on demand that is customized or personalized to my audience? I think there's a lot of revenue there.
Yeah. And well, just on that, are there any particular sites that you recommend to people? Because I think people only really know, you know, the sort of older sites like Zazzle, which are just not very good quality.
Yeah. No, the answer right now is no. I think there's a big opportunity. I think, unfortunately, the merchandise space in the music market is quite resistant to change. It's largely a cash business. So you could be a merchandise company and you go into a, you know, a Wembley Stadium where U2 is playing and, you know, you make $2.5 million that night selling merch. It's all cash. Do you want to necessarily transform your business to become a very transparent, very traceable digital business? There's quite a bit of resistance. So no, there actually aren't very many popular merchandise sites. It's usually the band site themselves that's selling that merchandise, or it's available at the performance that you go to.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think there is a big gap there because authors, like I'm looking at the moment at this sort of merchandising space and going, okay, but the quality, if you want the quality, then print on demand can be quite difficult because of that, especially, and with personalization, you need that. So I think that that will come. Let's say that's going to happen in the next couple of years. But I also wanted to ask you about indie versus big labels, because indie author has become, you know, it's what I call myself. I'm an indie author. I'm an independent author. I am not attached to a large company that is owned by Rupert Murdoch or something like that. But there is still stigma. There is still this separation between traditionally published authors and indie authors or self-published authors. So how did that shift in music? Because it does seem that has shifted.
I think there are similarities and there are some distinctions that are worth noting. I think in the book world, it's possible to have a decent, if not better, career as an indie author because you've still got the ability to monetize your craft. In the music world, your default position is you're an indie artist. Everyone starts as an indie artist. No artist ever gets signed to a label or publishing deal without first being an indie artist. Mm. It's a myth that, you're signed and then developed into, a talented performer. These days, you first got to prove that you have an audience, that you're able to fill the room in successive evenings in a city, that you've got a mailing list, that you've got awareness, that you've got streams that are getting played before any label or publisher will even think about signing you. Mm. Now, I think because the revenue is difficult for an independent musician, it really comes from performing live and selling merchandise. That's where you can make your money. And it's a difficult life, living on the road. You've heard all the horror stories, I'm sure.
Indeed.
It's a very difficult life. You can do it when you're young for a while, and then it becomes less appealing to people. So I've worked with tens of thousands of musicians in my online school, and no matter how successful they become as an independent artist, they always want to get signed to a big label. There is no stigma. They're always chasing that brass ring. No matter if I hammer it into their head that you're going to be more, you'll be in better control of your destiny. You'll keep, 80% of the money yourself. You can do whatever you want. You have complete creative control. At the end of the day, 95% of them come to me and say, "Dave, can you get me a record deal?"
Yeah, okay. So, and I think, and it's interesting because I think the publishing industry is shifting more into that. Certainly with nonfiction, they want people with an audience. With fiction, you still get these debut hits where, this first book comes out and they see if it becomes big and then they put money into it. But I think it's changing and a lot of big name indies have been picked up by traditional publishing. So that is an interesting parallel. Oh, so I could talk to you for hours about all this stuff, but we are running out of time. I do want to just ask you one last question, which is thinking about the future. So up front, you mentioned AI, we've mentioned VR, some of the technologies, perhaps a new format that's coming, discoverability, perhaps with AI machine learning engines or something like that. What do you see kind of coming in the next 5 years? What are you excited about in terms of the industry?
You've touched on many of the things that I would try and answer that question with. I do believe and am searching for the new format that is an entertainment experience that's largely based on music. I don't know what that format is yet, but I expect that we'll see one shortly. Because the record companies they're suffering, and they need a kick in the pants, if you will. They need something new to sell to people. It's been their business model forever. Is how can I reissue the catalog on a new appealing format? So I think that there's quite a bit of economic pressure to see some new format come, whether it's some form of VR or some kind of immersive concert-like experience that you can appreciate, from your living room. More likely than not, it's going to be that where you're able to purchase things during the show and perhaps get that personalization happening. I can't point to a company right now that's, put your investment in that. But I think it's going to be somewhere in that realm. My best answer.
No, I totally agree. And actually, I don't know, it's because I'm an introvert. I don't like crowds. So I will never go to a live concert. I just won't. I just don't want to be with crowds. But I would love to go on a, like a virtual ticket, like a VR experience. I'd love to be, I'm showing my age, like Bon Jovi. I still like to see Bon Jovi because I'm that old. Yeah. And I'd love to be able to do that in virtual reality so I don't have to actually be in a stadium. So it's kind of, that's kind of odd. I totally agree with you there. So tell people where they can find you and all your resources online.
Sure. Well, I have two main projects that I'm working on now. One is called Create Biz. That's create.biz. And basically, we're developing content marketing and business-related online courses for creative people, for writers, for musicians, for visual artists. So if you go to create.biz/pen, that's P-E-N-N.
It is.
you can get a guide to content marketing for creatives. As far as the music side goes, my online school is called New Artist Model, newartistmodel.com. We have courses in basic music business, in online marketing, in songwriting, in music theory. And I have a book that you can also get for free. It's called Hack the Music Business. If you go to hackmusic.com, you can get a copy of that book for free.
Oh, I'm going to go and get that. That sounds great. Well, look, Dave, this has been so fascinating and I'm really looking forward to seeing what you're going to do in the next year or two and us too. So we'll definitely connect again. So thanks so much for your time.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me and good luck to you.
So I hope you enjoyed the interview with Dave Cusack. Certainly a lot to think about in terms of where the music industry is and where we are heading as authors. Next week, I have an interview on using improv and stand-up comedy techniques for creativity, plus some Facebook tips with Andrea Vall. And we discuss why leaning into yes can help you write and let go of self-censorship, which is something I know many authors struggle with and something I have definitely struggled with in the past. So happy writing and I'll see you next week. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes and show notes available at thecreativepen.com/podcast. You can also get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.